So just like yesterday, Friday evening was Bhakti Riksha Plus. We'll expand it. So this is Bhakti Riksha group members plus more. How many persons present are a little on the newer side to the practice of devotional service and Krishna consciousness like we're doing? A little bit newer, on the newer side? Okay. The group that meets here regularly, the topic that's being discussed presently is Chapter 2 of Bhagavad Gita. Yes? Chapter 2 Bhagavad Gita. And Chapter 2 Bhagavad Gita, the subject matter, well, the title of it is Contents of the Gita Summarized. So if you can understand Chapter 2 of Bhagavad Gita, you can understand the whole of Bhagavad Gita in a summary form, and then it's expanded and expanded and further expanded. But the two main subjects in Chapter 2 of Bhagavad Gita are Samkhya Yoga and Buddhi Yoga. What's Samkhya Yoga?
Analytical study of matter and spirit.
Very good. Yes. So, I'm going to show in a little bit, do a little presentation here, but the number of people, I mentioned this on Friday evening, the number of persons who, rather, the percentage of Americans today, those living in America, the percentage of them that believe in the soul is 80%. And in 1981, George Gallup Jr., the chairman of the Department of Statistics at Princeton University, did a study, and the study was 21% of the Americans in 1981 accepted the presence of the soul. That's a pretty big jump from 1981 to the year 2000. And the research attributes two main factors: immigration of people from eastern part of the world to America who have that conception already, and another was the increasing body of evidence, not proof, but evidence that there is such a thing as a soul distinct from matter. Now, modern science doesn't teach that. Modern science teaches there's only one thing. This is mechanistic science. And that's matter. And the laws that govern matter go along with matter, and that's all there is. And anything that exists can be explained based upon matter and the laws that govern matter. There isn't a second thing or a third thing. It's all there is. So, all of us, to one degree or another, have some education. Looking around the room, probably like a lot of years of study in the academic halls of the world, U.S. and America, and U.S. and India, and it doesn't teach about the soul, but somehow there's this conviction that there's a soul. Now, what the nature of the soul is starts getting fuzzy for different people who have different ideas of what the soul is. In fact, in my 40-something years of serving Srila Prabhupada in the role of his devotee, I've encountered hilarious varieties of conceptions of what the soul is. And because I want to do this at the presentation, it won't go into a laughter session, but it's like really a riot. So many different. So of those 80% that say they believe in the soul, it's not the soul that we believe in. But they have some idea. So just like on Friday evening, the group, Bhakti Riksha group, is studying Chapter 9, Bhagavad Gita. And so we discussed the verse, Yad Kuroshi, Yad Asnasi, Yad Jahosi, Dadasi, Yad Tapasyasi Kaunteya, Tat Kurasha Madarpanam. So that Madarpanam is a very important part. There are many different conceptions of what Madarpanam means. Like, start with impersonal and personal. And then there's varieties of both. And then subdivisions and further divisions. So, if one has a misconception of who you should offer everything unto as a form of worship, the result is going to be different than that which is actually supreme. And the tendency to worship, according to Krishna's indication to Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita, it's there. It's intrinsic to the soul. If someone doesn't worship God, they'll worship something. And according to where they worship, they have a different destination. Yanti deva vrata devan. Pitkin yanti pritin vrataha. Bhutani yanti bhute. So some persons are ghost worshippers. It's like becoming a trendy thing from the Harry Potter movies and all the other stuff that's going on. There's a lot of like fascination with witches. You might be surprised. One day your child comes home from school and what? You're worshiping witches? Wait a minute. But there's another destination for those who worship Krishna. And they go to Krishna. Those who worship Krishna go to Krishna. So same with the soul. If we're going to make a distinction between spirit and matter, as Krishna's teaching in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Sankhya, then we need a right conception. And so the topic that I was asked to speak about was a how-to question, but I thought I'll do the what question before we do the how-to question. How to transform material consciousness or material conception of life to the spiritual conception of life. That's the how-to. Like there's a magic switch and you just have to know the secret password and you get into that special information data and esoteric and just pull the switch and boom, you're in the spiritual conception. That's not how it works. It's an open secret. It's a matter of the how-to is practicing sadhana bhakti in a proper way and just putting it in simple terms, Prabhupada's expression. As the sun rises in the morning, simultaneously you can see yourself and you can see the sun. In abject darkness, you can't see yourself. Even if you have a mirror, you can't see yourself. You can't even see the mirror, or to speak of the reflection in the mirror. But when the sun rises, you can see the sun, you can see yourself. Similarly, God realization and self realization, they occur gradually and simultaneously. So the process of God realization is to awaken that. That's the how-to switch. Practice sadhana bhakti very carefully, and the consciousness of our real identity, especially when it's guided by proper spiritual conception, becomes reality, and the darkness is dispelled and the light comes on. There's all this language used in Vedanta Sutra commentaries by our acharyas when they refer to things like pots and plates and describing what Maya is, and Maya is not seeing anything or seeing something that's not what is there. And it's all due to illusion or darkness. And when there's no darkness is gone, the light is there, then you can see things such as pots and plates. In other words, you can see differences, distinctions. You can see variety within this material world, distinct from who you are. You're not a pot or a plate. You can see matter and spirit, distinct, as God consciousness awakens. But that requires right concept of God and right concept of spirit, the soul. So before you do the, maybe you know these three terms, sambandhagyan, avideyagyan, and prayojanagyan. If you don't, I'll explain them, and if you do, you'll just remember them. According to the discussion that Lord Chaitanya had with the Mayavad Sannyasi Prakashananda Saraswati, there are three divisions of subject matters within all of the Vedas. You can like one, two, three buckets. Sambandha means relationship, same as the Hindi word. Sambandha means relationship. Everything comes from a source. That source is the absolute truth, and everything that comes from the source has a relationship with the source. And understanding the relationship of all things with their source is sambandha gyan. So when souls, the next category is when souls act within that relationship, that constitutes avideya, actions within the relationship with the Supreme, performing devotional service. How to perform devotional service is avideya gyan. And then the fruit of acting in one's relationship with the Supreme, up to the stage of love of God, prema, prayojana, it's in the category of prayojana gyan. So, relationship, acting in the relationship, the fruit of that relationship. Those are the three categories. Sambandha, avideya, prayojana. So before we go to the how-to, that's the avideya, the middle one, let's do the what. What's the nature of the soul? In fact, to help, something that Srila Prabhupada expressed on a number of occasions, but very strongly in relation to his translation of the fifth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, was that because the fifth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam is presenting Vedic cosmology. What's cosmology? It's a description of what's up there in the sky, the structure of the universe. That's cosmology. So the Vedic picture of cosmology is in the fifth canto, and Prabhupada was very strong in his purports of what the Vedic cosmology says and comparing it or contrasting it with what mechanistic science says, and he turned a few heads and spun a few minds, and even amongst his own followers, like, hey, what's going on? This isn't what we learned in eighth grade science class. It's very different. And then Prabhupada explained the reason for that reaction is that not just in the Western world, but, you know, Western world gets a big, you know, contribution in this area. The what modern science says, people have practically blind faith. Like the scientists criticize the religionists that they have blind faith in God, but the religionists look at the scientists and say, you have blind faith in the scientist says. And then the response to that is, well, why do you say that? Look at all the wonderful things that science has done over the number of years. And if science says there's no soul, then, you know, prove to me that there's soul. Well, wait a minute. How about proving that there's no soul? The burden of proof becomes over on this side, that prove that there is. We can stand off, prove that there isn't. So, because there is such a strong faith, confidence in science says, I put together a presentation that where science says, at least evidence that's in modern science, that there is a soul. Not proof, but evidence in that direction. I'll do one that's like, you know, science says. In ancient, not only Vedic, but Eastern cosmology, the conception of the universe is geocentric. Geo means the earth. So with the earth at the center, describing where the planets are in the cosmos is described in geocentric terms. And that was fine until Copernicus came along. And Copernicus said, boo, hiss, no. The earth isn't the center, the sun is the center. And the planets are moving around the sun. So the Copernican model, like, displaced and trashed the geocentric model. And in Copernicus's time, he'd said other things like the size of the moon is X, and the distance between the earth and the sun is Y. So over a period of time, because he developed a telescope and he could see and said the distance is, this is the distance and that's the size. So as time passed from the time of Copernicus, they built better telescopes. And Y became a very different number, because the number that they say today was off by a factor of something like 180. That's a pretty big factor. And then, you know, at this point in time, the Hubble telescopes that are mounted on spacecraft and sending around zoom, 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 and send pictures back, and they can, based on where they are, they can take a measurement of where they are, what the picture says, and the distance is what it is today according to the Vedic model of the distance between the Earth and the Sun, and the size of the Sun, and the size of the Earth. Okay? So the numbers match, but what about geocentric and heliocentric? How come the Vedic model says geocentric? Geocentric means from your point of observation is the Earth, and then the movements of the heavenly bodies are in terms of your point of observation. So I'm going to do a little hand motion thing because I don't have a chart with me, so just... you have to watch my hands. Here's the earth, and there's the motion of the moon that's moving around the earth. Yes? So, and over here is the sun, big sun, and the earth over here, and the moon moving around the earth. Now listen carefully. If you were to make a map, here's the sun. Here's the Earth moving around the Sun. We're looking at it from the top down, vertical. And then you're going to map the Moon that moves around the Earth as the Earth moves around the Sun. So the Earth is moving like this, and the Sun, the Moon is moving like this, but you're just mapping the Moon. What does the map look like? It's a spiral, or helix. Now keep doing that like hundreds and thousands of times. And what do you get? You get an inner tube. Or if it's just flat, you get a ring, an outer and inner ring. But sometimes it's higher altitude, lower altitude, so it comes out like, you know, a lifesaver or a tube. Right? That's if you're mapping the moon as the moon moves around the earth, as the earth goes around the sun. Okay, now, clear your mind, wipe the slate clean. Now we'll do step two. Step two is, the Vedas describe, and modern astronomy, Western astronomy, describes that the not only the Earth is moving around the Sun, but the Sun is moving once a year on an ecliptic plane. That's what it's called, ecliptic. And it moves from the northern direction down, 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 down to the southern part of this Earth planet. For those people in the northern hemisphere, that southernmost point is Makara Sankranti, or depends on where you are. What's it? Isn't the other name in South India? Pongal?
Pongal.
So, January 14th. That's the date. It's a solar date. It doesn't change because it's when the sun is in the southernmost. And then it goes up, 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 up. And then it crosses the equator where days and nights are equal. So that's an equinox. And boop, 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 and goes up to the summer solstice, where the sun is in the northernmost position, June 14th or something like that. And then boop, 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 crosses the equator again. Days and nights are equal. So days are longest, nights are longest, and then there's the equinox in the course of 1 year. So in addition to the Earth's moving, the sun is moving in relation to the Earth. Okay, now, if you were looking at the, here's the Earth at the center of a circle, and the Earth, the sun is moving on its ecliptic once a year, slowly, once a year, and other planets are moving, let's say Mars is moving around the sun, as the sun is moving around the Earth, you map out Mars, motion of Mars, what do you get? A helix or spiral, and then you do it many, many, many times, and you get two circles with an inner and outer edge. Yes? Same thing. From the perspective of the Earth, what's the motion of Mars or Venus or Jupiter, Saturn, or all the planets as they move around the Earth, as they move around the Sun, as the Sun is moving around the Earth? Geocentric model. So you take those inner and outer limits, and you look at those numbers of the distance that Mars is from the Earth, and you get the numbers that are what modern science says the numbers are. Or actually, it's the other way around. It's what modern science is getting closer and closer to the Vedic model. with precise numbers, you know, the measure was yojanas. And we use miles, and somebody else might use kilometers, and you can have some other, you know, terminology. But when you do the math, it comes out. And so the Vedas describe this Bhumandala, that's the Earth plane, the plane of the upper, middle, and lower planetary systems where the Earth resides, is Bhumandala. And it describes where there's a central island, and then an ocean, and then a circular island, which you never see circular islands, and then with an inner and outer diameter, and then another ocean, and then a circular island. And those islands are numerically the inner and the outer orbits of the motions of the different planets as the planets are moving around the sun, as the sun is moving around the Earth. You got it? Cool, huh? Geocentric. With practically a one-to-one correlation with modern science says that's heliocentric model of where the planets are in space according to, you know, the math that you say where they are in space, away from the sun and similar. You know, you can map. It's just, it's relative motion, and you can just have a different set of numbers or different equation when you plug the numbers in and you do the math, and it comes out the right numbers, geocentric or heliocentric. The unique thing is, the Vedic conclusion was not reached by use of Hubble telescopes. Use the unassisted eye And you're not going to get anything close to those numbers. Even with a crude telescope, it's 180 times off. So how did they get those numbers? And the answer is by descending knowledge. As the whole of the Vedas comes by descending knowledge. So modern science has its, modern astronomy has its technology where they can detect distances more accurately than they could previously. And similarly, I'm going to show you a little presentation where modern science gets some stronger indication about the presence of the soul than it did in 1981 when George Gallup made his poll and 21% of the population in America said, "We believe that there's a soul." Okay, so we're going to show this picture right here. If those of you that are back there and can't see this wall, there's some space right here. There's like a lot of space right here. And if you don't want to see the picture, that's okay too. And especially for the kids that are in the front row, this is going to be, part of this is going to be like a science class. So I hope you don't mind. I mean, it's a Saturday, and why should you be going to a science class on a Saturday? But I hope you like it. And I'll try to go slowly, at least when it comes to the science things, and like explain it in simple language. Who is that a picture of? Benjamin Franklin. And he's on a $100 bill. He's such an important guy. And at least in America, he's an important guy in the history of America. Now, why would I show you a picture of a $100 bill? Because Benjamin Franklin is one of the persons in American history who had a strong conviction in reincarnation or the existence of the soul beyond the body. Oh, because that was another. In the year 2000, those persons that accepted that there's a soul was around 80%, and those that accepted there's existence of the soul beyond this life, or there's life after this life, it was almost the same number. I don't, if you say that you believe in the soul but it doesn't exist after this life, I don't know what that conviction is, but it goes out of existence after you die, but there's a soul. Anyway, it was something like 76%. So Benjamin Franklin was ahead of his times. When he was just a teenager, mind you, he drafted this epitaph that is on his gravestone. "The body of B. Franklin, printer, like the cover of an old book, its contents torn out and stripped of its lettering and gilding, lies here, food for worms. But the work shall not be lost, for it will be, as he believed, appear once more in a new and more elegant edition, corrected and improved by the author." He was a teenager when he wrote this. And throughout his life, he had deep conviction in reincarnation. The British Prime Minister, David Lloyd George. This is for a Western audience. If I was, anyway, different audience, we'd have different people here. Henry Ford was a strong believer in reincarnation, as is his grandson, Ambarish, Alfred Ford. Plato, of course, very strong believer in soul beyond this body. Charles Dickens. You'll have to read some of Charles Dickens' writings probably in your high school English classes. So he was a strong believer in reincarnation. The Russian author, Leo Tolstoy. Immanuel Kant in Western Europe. Rudyard Kipling, more modern writer. Aldous Huxley. And this is, he isn't a believer in reincarnation exactly. He's a, as I described. So this is a slide that for the presentation is saying his 1981 results and then the year 2000 results, and the reasons are immigration of Eastern origin persons into America who have that conviction, and science. So the immigration number is not like, doesn't account for 60% increase. It's the scientific portion. So now we're going to go to some earlier science, to the Renaissance time. René Descartes, very handsome man, who was a Frenchman. And what do you know from science class, you know, from math class about René Descartes? Pythagorean theorem?
Is that?
Yeah. Okay. Well, he was also a scientist and also an author, and he was very interested in the what's called in the realm of science the mind-body problem. Now, at the end of there, you can play a little video clip where Sataputta is narrating and he's explaining. René Descartes had this idea that there's a distinction between the mind and the body, and the two interact. But he couldn't prove it, and so towards the end, modern science just like laughed him off and dismissed the whole thing. But that was like an early stage presentation of the mind-body problem. So here it is. This isn't the soul and body, but it's just the mind and body. And even that, the Renaissance people had a problem with.
This brings us naturally to the idea that consciousness involves a non-physical entity that is able to sense material patterns and tie them together in a unified awareness of self. Such an idea was introduced by René Descartes in the 17th century. According to Descartes, there are two kinds of substances, matter, or res extensa, and mind, or res cogitans. Matter has geometrical properties involving extension in space, and mind is characterized by thinking, feeling, and conscious awareness. Descartes proposed that the mind interacts with the body. Sense perception involves the transmission of information from the body to the mind, and willed action involves the transmission of information from the mind to the body. Descartes speculated that the center of mind-body interaction might be the pineal gland situated in the center of the head. Over the years, scientists and philosophers have been unable to make any progress in understanding how a non-physical mind might interact with the physical body. As a result, they have tended to reject this idea in preference for purely mechanical theories of the mind.
Okay, that was a quick rendering. So, fast forward over time, and there has been a renewed interest in consciousness, and this gentleman pictured here is Dr. John Searle, a physicist, who had a theory that says actually consciousness is just an inherent property of matter. And he called it the supervene theory. So it's just like when consciousness is in, when matter is in a certain state, consciousness kind of squirts out of it, like, you know, a sponge and there's water, and you squeeze the sponge and all the water comes out. It's already there in the sponge, it just has to be squeezed. The supervene theory. Then a fellow physicist, of course, had to disagree with him. And William Seeger said, just like you take the example of ice, so in one condition it's water, another condition it's ice, but there it has to do with the structure of water at a certain temperature. It has a lattice structure and it makes it for ice. And in the temperature of water, there's no lattice structure, so it isn't hard. But that's a property of matter. There's nothing known about the property of neurons that supervenes and squirts out consciousness from the neurons. So here's a little video that talks about this, and I'm going to describe it a little bit ahead of time, just very briefly. It's called The articles that describe it call the Chinese room game. It was the counter-argument that William Seeger gave. He said, for example, supposing you set a bunch of people, American people, in a room at desks, and then you tell each person in that series of groups, when you receive a slip of paper, you make a mark like this, then you pass that on to the next person, you make a mark like that, pass it on to the next person, you make a mark like something else, and it goes around the whole room, and at the other end, you get a Chinese paragraph. All they're doing is making a mark on a slip of paper. And so if you say that consciousness is a series of neurons producing events that make consciousness, then it would be equivalent to making marks on paper, by because all that the neurons are doing, or computers are doing, when MIT and other places for several decades were trying to make artificial intelligence, it's a behavior, but it's not consciousness that's being exhibited. Neurons don't exhibit consciousness, and he gave the Chinese room game as an example, and here it is explained briefly in the video.
If we accept the reality of consciousness, we can ask the question, can a machine be conscious? The philosopher John Surath has thrown interesting light on this question by presenting the following argument. Consider the computer that duplicates the brain activity of Mr. Jones. Suppose that it is conscious, just as Mr. Jones himself would be. The important thing about this computer is its logical structure, which duplicates the logical structure of Mr. Jones' brain. This same logical structure can be embodied in a computer consisting of a large group of people seated at desks. In accordance with certain simple rules, each person receives slips of paper from his neighbors, makes marks on them, and passes them to other neighbors. By setting up the rules properly, this group of people would precisely duplicate all of the operations of the Jones computer. Just as the Jones computer duplicates Mr. Jones' brain, so this group of people collectively duplicates both the Jones computer and Mr. Jones' brain. Does the group of people manifest the consciousness of Mr. Jones? Each individual in the group knows only his own activities of making marks on pieces of paper, and we can suppose that he does not even know the purpose of the group as a whole. Surely the consciousness of Mr. Jones is not present in any of the individuals in the group, but is it present in the group as a whole? It seems most reasonable to suppose that, in fact, the only consciousness in the group of people is that of the individuals that make it up. But if this is so, then what can we say about the Jones computer? Shouldn't we conclude that it also lacks consciousness and is simply producing behavior by a mechanical process? Finally, what about Mr. Jones' brain? What special feature does it have that creates the conscious experience of Mr. Jones? Its logical structure as a computer is the same as that of the Jones computer and the group of people. It only differs from them in the way its operations are carried out, by nerve impulses instead of by electrical currents in semiconductors or by the passing of written notes. A nerve cell builds up an electrical potential between its inside and its outside. A nerve impulse involves a localized flow of ions across the cell membrane that neutralizes this electrical potential.
I'm going to stop there because it's like a lot of information. For those of you that have a medical background, you know what was just said. Or those that have a little bit more of a science background know what was just said. This is a wave propagation down a cell wall, where on one side of the cell membrane is a positive charge, the other side is a negative charge, and so to neutralize those positive negative charges, a signal propagates down the length of the neuron. This is what modern science say is all consciousness is this. It's a neutralization of a positive charge and a negative charge across the cell wall, the cell membrane. That's all it is. And there's a series of those, and you put them together, and the collective phenomena is what you guys that are sentimental call consciousness. So what's going on here is he's showing, just as a computer may make a behavior, you can create a computer. They did it. They made a computer that plays chess. But it's only based upon how the computer is programmed. When it detects something, then it, based on the capacity of the person that did the programming to know programming and know how to play chess, he can input it and it can make the behavior, but it can't make discriminations. It can only conduct a behavior that's input in it. It's not conscious. So neurons making propagating of waves down the cell membrane, or a computer, or the Chinese room making mark. It's just a behavior, making a mark on a slip of paper, passing it on. Same thing. You know, it's a one or a zero, pass it on in computer technology. And same thing in the neuron. So where is consciousness in all this? Where is Mr. Jones, as he's saying, the consciousness of Mr. Jones? That's the argument he's making.
As this flow takes place, it triggers a similar flow in adjacent parts of the membrane. Thus, an electrical signal propagates down the length of the cell. From a computational point of view, the important thing is that some kind of signal is sent. The particular mechanism does not matter. The same thing can be said about the switching functions carried out by neurosynapses. The theory of the brain as a computer holds that only the logical arrangement of neural interconnections is important in determining human mental functions. We have seen that this logical structure does not account for consciousness. Could it be that consciousness is a product of the particular physiochemical structure of neurons? Actually, there is no more reason to associate consciousness with this cellular machinery than there is to associate it with the amplifier and photocell of the red light machine.
I'm going to show you a picture of a red light machine in a moment, but maybe I'll just do that. I'll just go to the red light machine. There's a red light machine. And the argument of the red light machine is, I actually had somebody, a devotee named Vidyabhusan, a god brother of mine, made one for me for presentations at colleges. It was bigger than this one. It was like, you know, I carry it in a big box. But it had the same elements. There was a camera lens, so that receives light. And then behind the camera lens, there's these cables that were hooked up to photo-sensitive or light-sensitive chips. So that is, if the frequency of light was yellow, it would activate that chip. If it was green, it would activate the green chip. If it was blue, it would activate the blue chip. And then it would, that wafer, the chip, sent a signal to an amplifier. And then the amplifier did three different things. Well, it did two different things. You could make it talk, too. It printed out on a strip of paper like this, I see a red light, I see a blue light, I see a green light, I see whatever the color light is. Or then another was a digital message went up, I see a red light. So it was a behavior. Or you can get it to say it, program it to say it, I see a red light. Now, looking at the machine, where's consciousness? Where's that event of conscious awareness taking place in the machine? There's a behavior that's computational, and there's a perception of light, but where's consciousness? In the mechanistic view, consciousness doesn't have a place. That's the point of the red light machine. So where's conscious awareness? We know that there is such a thing as conscious awareness, and one explanation of it is it's just mechanistic. It's just a neurological event. You folks that talk about consciousness, humbug. All it is electrochemical events in the brain. Nothing else. So he's going through the little exercise, little rigorous, but you get the message, I hope, that the neurological events is not, in principle, from a computational point, not any different than what the artificial intelligence folks have been doing to try to simulate consciousness, or the Chinese room game. Where's the consciousness of Mr. Jones in that room full of people? It's not there. Nor is it there in the robot, nor is it there in the brain, or the neurons of the brain. It's something else. And some of the something else's, here's some other evidence. You know of this name, Dr. Michael Sabam, from Emory University, from the little book that the DBT has published called Beyond Birth and Death. No, not Beyond Birth and Death. What's the title of the book?
Life After
Death. Life After Death. Is that it?
Life comes from life.
Life comes from life.
No, not life comes from life. The picture is shown. It's this picture here. Where's that picture?
Coming back.
Okay. Dr. Michael Sabam is pictured, is written about in Coming Back. So here's the doctor. And he had an associate, I don't think it was at Emory University, but another university, an esteemed surgeon, heart surgeon, who wrote his books. And it's based upon... Dr. Michael Sabam's writing is after about 12 years of research. Something happened during open heart surgery one time that blew his mind. It was a patient had cardiac arrest, and they did the procedure to get his heart to start pumping again by artificial means, and his heart started beating of its own accord after that. And he survived the cardiac arrest and the heart surgery. And at the end, recovery time, the doctor went to see his patient and asked him how he was feeling. And he said, "I feel great," and described the whole event of the cardiac arrest. And doctor said, "You know, what are you talking about?" He said, "Yes, I was up on top of, hovering up above the operating table, looking down." And he described in detail what happened. You know, the little meter said heart stopped, and the assistant said to the nurse, "Get those electrodes and place them on his chest." And they did that, and you know, certain things happened. And the doctor said this and that. Just described in detail what happened and how long it took, and then what they did after that. And then Dr. Sabam said, "This is impossible. How's he? He must be making this up. There must be some explanation for this besides." So he took it seriously. And then he started researching and found that there are other patients that had similar experiences. And then it started being given a name, out-of-body experience. And then they gave an acronym for it, OBE. No, it is America. OBE. And he studied it for a number of years, and he wrote a book about it. And he explained, you know, I wanted to debunk this idea. I looked to see maybe it's too much carbon dioxide and there's some hallucination, maybe it's too much oxygen, maybe it's this, maybe it's that, and did experiments and found it wasn't any of those things. The conclusion is there's the seat of consciousness, like this picture. The seat of consciousness is something different than the body, and it's certainly different than the neurons of the body, because when there's cardiac arrest, what happens is the blood doesn't go to the brain. The neurological events don't happen because the blood isn't flowing, because there's cardiac arrest. It's like not even possible. And still that there's conscious awareness when there's no neurological events, it's got to be another explanation. The seat of consciousness is something else, whatever that something else is. So these two doctors wrote their books, and I didn't do an exhaustive study, but there's something like 20, 25 MDs, you know, reputable people, not like, you know, silly people, who have done similar studies of out-of-body experiences specific with cardiac arrest. This is another physician, Dr. David Ray Griffin. Won't give you all the details. Here's one where Dr. Kimberly Clark Sharp, University of Washington in Seattle. I like one of the stories. The first event that happened to her was a patient reported that survived cardiac arrest. They were on the operating table, and they described how they floated up above the operating table, went to the ceiling, went across the ceiling, out a window, and up two flights outside the operating room, and they were looking eyeball to eyeball with a pair of sneakers that were outside the janitor's room on a little ledge. And she thought, this is ridiculous. So she got the patient described what was inside the janitor's room. And so he went to the janitor and said, you know, can you open your room and tell me? And he said, I put a new lock on it. I just rearranged it. So as the woman described, then they looked, there is a ledge outside the window of the janitor's room, but you can't see it from inside. You have to be outside. And there was a pair of sneakers. And the lady described, you know, they had different color shoelaces, and there was a rip in the toe of one of the sneakers. Like details that you can't see unless you're outside. So Dr. Kimberly Clark Sharp said, you know, this is ridiculous. What's the explanation for this? And she began researching and came to a similar conclusion, that there's the seat of consciousness is something other than the neurological events that take place in the brain. These two gentlemen from different countries, this one I think is from Sweden and this one is from Iceland, and they collaborated and they studied 438 different cases. Let's go to the... There we go. So this is what happened. There's this Carlos Osis is an American psychologist, and he and his friend studied 442 deathbed experiences in the USA and 435 in India, where persons had this out-of-body experience in their deathbed, and they came to a similar conclusion. And these are things that people described when they came back from their out-of-body experiences. There, this long tunnel with some light at the end, and figures with wings flying in the air, and light and illumination, very, very brilliant, practically blinding, and so forth. So, I'll go quickly. This is a photograph. This is another of beyond the body. There's life. This is a photograph of a spirit or ghost standing at a railing, because this particular spirit or ghost was known to be in a certain area, and somebody, photographer, got a picture of her. And here's a medium. I met a medium the other day. Won't tell you where, but you know, they're able to, other than their own voice or their own consciousness, express and experience the consciousness of some other beings. So here's the coming back cover, where the picture is as one exits this world in the later stage of life, when the soul comes back again in some other form. And right here we're in Virginia, right?
Yes.
So Ian Stevenson is with the University of Virginia, I believe, and here he is a little younger than he was then than he is today, and he did a lot of study on persons remembering their previous lives. And this is a famous one that existed was very prominent in the 1930s from India, before he started his work, and later he came and looked at all the records and found it quite in order. But this is, let's see, Shanti, who previously was Swarnalata, and that gives the statistics about her life. But she, when she was just a small girl, like 3 years old, she was describing that my name isn't Swarnalata, my name is Shanti. No, the other way around. My name is not Shanti, my name is Swarnalata. And she described all kinds of things about her life as Swarnalata. What was her husband's name, where she lived, what her husband did, what was in the house, the names of the relatives, and just went on and on. A little three-year-old girl that one might take as just a babbling of a small child, but just like continued and continued and continued. And so as they listened to what she said, they found the name of what she said was her husband. And so without telling their little girl, they brought the husband, who is now, you know, a grown-up man, and she's a little three-year-old girl. As soon as he walked into the house unannounced, there he is, there's my husband. Immediately. And then they were amazed, and so they had her go to the house. That's this picture here. And when she went to the house, she got bewildered. She went right from the train station, walked straight to the house, and when she got to the house, she was bewildered because they had remodeled the house after she left, and the door was now on the side instead of in the front. So when they went inside the house, she was able to identify the details of the house, where she died, the name of the doctor that treated her. She pointed him out of a crowd of people. That's the doctor that treated me. And this is the husband that came and visited unannounced, and immediately she recognized. When she went into the house, she immediately recognized her brother and her husband and her son. And there was a little box in the house where they had some rupees. It was hidden that only the husband and wife knew. So she identified where the box was, and the husband said, I needed the money, I took the money. So things that you can't just like make it up. Here she's leading him from the train station to the house and identifying the people. So there are other persons. This is an American woman, Carol Bowman, whose little boy, Chase, at the age of 5, was having past life memories. And I've seen a YouTube video of this family, and then another family where the son was like a World War II pilot and remembering all of those details. So Carol Bowman's son described a war zone where, like, this is his own little handwriting, where this is where he was, and then, you know, a cannon came in, and some military troops came in, and suddenly he got shot, and he died. Here's this opening for the soldiers to come in. The soldiers came in, and he got shot. There's the cannon, the horse pulling the cannon. So it was from the Civil War era, and he was remembering in details, higher, higher I go into the sky, after he was shot. So past life remembrances says, if I'm in this body today, but I can remember in detail life in a previous body, it says something. Consciousness is not the body. Here's two examples of another category of hypnotic regression, where Peter Ramster on the left is the voice that you're going to hear, and his very scruffy-looking companion there, Robert McGregor, who together worked on hypnotic regression. And here's two little video clips of this. And I'll just do a little preview. The woman that's lying is under hypnotic state, and she's lives in Australia. She's never been out of Australia. And she starts describing in a previous life she was somebody in England. And she describes the town, the name, the family, the details, the place where she lived, a waterfall, it had tiers and steps coming down, and where the house was in relation to that, where the window was in the house, and details and details and details in another part of the world that she's never been. And then they took her there, and she recognized everything just as it was in hypnotic trance many generations earlier. Here we go.
Reincarnation experiments are striking examples of unprejudiced scientific study. Our first case history is Gwen McDonald, a housewife living in Australia who had never left her native New South Wales. Under regression, she claimed to be Mary Duncan, a woman living in the county of Somerset about 200 years ago. Interesting name, but not there. Not on the most modern and large-scale maps. Go to the older ones, back to the 18th century, and suddenly the names began to leak out. Alfred was there. Stone became Stone Chapel. And there was Hornblotten, very close to the way she pronounced it.
I know it's mine.
Mary Duncan, but they call me Rose.
Then she named the people of the area. The names were found in the old records.
What's your mother's? Dougie Lane. The parents of the children.
Lethbridge, Bessie said. I'm the tender of a Lethbridge. Tender of the grandfather.
When they took her to Somerset in England, they took as their independent witness Dr. Basil Cottle, reader in medieval English studies at Bristol University. Under trance, Gwen described the path to the cottage in which she had lived. The path crossed a fork in a stream where there was a unique stepped waterfall. Everything was just as she said it would be. The fork, the feared waterfall.
And just to do it slowly, there's a tiered waterfall that she described in her trance, and when she went to the place that she described in her trance, there was the fork in the stream, the tiered waterfall, just as she described it.
And she was off, moving with the purpose of someone who knows where she is and where to go. Led them unerringly on a beeline to the cottage. After finding the cottage in which she said she had lived, from the outside she described a window that was no longer there, and the wall was covered with ivy. From the inside, it was clear and unmistakable that a window had been there and was now filled in. This was only the beginning of many things she described in trance that proved to be correct.
Okay, so I think I'm going to skip the next one, just for sake of time. It's a woman, again, from Australia, who had never been out of Australia, and under trance she's speaking not only in French, but a Normandy dialect of French. And so there's a translator that knew the Normandy dialect, and the translator is explaining what she's saying, and she's describing several, or a couple hundred years ago, where she was married, what her life was like, and so on, in the chapel where she was married. in trance. So they went with her to that place in Normandy, France, and they saw the building, the chapel. It was like now just a shell. The roof was gone, and but some of the walls were there, and the place where her wedding took place was found, just as she described it, although in trance. Here's from the Stone Chapel, Hornblatten, Alford, seeing the waterfalls, seeing the place where she lived, and then the outside where the window was, but now it's covered so they can see that it was filled in from the way it originally was set up. And this is this other lady that's speaking in Normandy and finds the chapel where she was married. Now, I'm almost done. This next section is from the latest book of Ian Stevenson that he calls Where Biology and Reincarnation Intersect. So out of the whole pie of past life remembrances, he takes just that little slice of the pie where persons that remember their previous life have in this life some birthmark, a cot or something, a missing part of their body that's connected to their previous life. And so the way that he would do this is he'd get a report, he'd interview them thoroughly, the next step was he'd go to the birth records and see if that was there in their birth record, like this one. Here's someone from Thailand that had a mark in the back of his head, and the mark in the back of the head was he was murdered, hit in the head by some weapons, and he remembered the event from his previous life and his name and the names of the murderers he remembered. He remembered his daughter and the name of his daughter and recognized the daughter. He recognized the police officer that was involved, part of the murder scene was when he was killed. Part of his feet were damaged, so he remembered all these things. That then Ian Stevenson went to the birth record that showed this lesion was there in the back of his head and this problem with his toes. Then he went to the place where he said he was in his previous life and reconfirmed the whole thing. Here's another case. This one is in India, where someone was born without the fingers and the thumb of their right hand. And they then described that the hand in their previous life was cut off. Their fingers were cut off in a machine. They gave their name, where they live, and the father's name, and all the details. They go to the birth records, the fingers were missing at the time of birth. They went to the place where they said the person lived, and all the details confirmed. Here's another one where part of the leg is missing from birth, and the person said in the previous life they died being run over by a train. And so they verified in the same way, that the death certificate showed when the person died run over by a train of that name such and such, this part of the leg was missing. So then in their next birth, they were born with part of the leg missing. This is a very embarrassing one. This is Semmel Ferici becomes Semmel Hayek, showed that there's a lesion here in the upper part of his head, and there's also one in his chin. And he said, in my previous life, I was a murderer. And my brother and I were criminals, and we did all these bad things, and finally, the place where we lived, they got fed up with us, so they created a posse, and they came chasing us, and we ran. We went to the top of a mountain. We went into a little cottage. They surrounded the cottage, and I told my brother we're finished, so I shot my brother, and then I shot myself, and the bullet went in here and came out here. That's not a nice thing to have to report, but that's what he reported. And so, were those marks there at the time of birth? Yes. And they went back to the place, and sure enough, exactly as he described in previous life, that biological evidence is there to confirm his past life recollection. Here's another very embarrassing one. I'm going quickly just to give you the idea. this is a woman who is born with these marks on her legs, particularly her left leg. And she described that in her previous life she was a man, and she had committed adultery with another man's wife, and when the other man's wife, when the other husband found out, then he murdered him. He tied him up in ropes and threw him in the bottom of a well, and he died. So that's pretty embarrassing to have to confirm. And so, you know, the marks were there at this girl's birth, and the details and details, and even gave the name of the murderer. When Ian Stevenson's man went to the man who in the previous life was said to be the murderer, he admitted to it. Yes, I did it. Because this man had committed adultery with my wife. I don't know what happened with him after that. But so here in Washington, D.C. area, there was the one of the chief editors, whose name I can't remember right now, but kind of what struck me about this was because a Washington Post editor went to go visit Ian Stevenson with the idea that I'll just spend a day with him and then write this like debunking editorial on Ian Stevenson's garbage work. He came with that. He went with that disposition, and he spent the day with him and was so impressed, he came back and wrote just the opposite. You know, this man is doing amazing work. And then later he wanted to go on a tour with him. When he got some reports, how did he follow up with it? So they were sitting in a cafe somewhere in Southeast Asia. He said, how do you get these reports? And he said, you know, sometimes they just walk up. Like, so the editorial man said, here's somebody, he's our waiter, let's see if he's got a past life remembrance. And he did. And he had like a little mark on his body and said, this mark is from my previous life where my mother put this mark, because in this culture in Southeast Asia, so the parents, because they believe in reincarnation, they put a mark on their deceased child so they know who their child is in their next life because he got that mark. And there's a whole series of these, you know, where there's a mark on their elbow or a mark on their foot. And so they followed up in the presence of this Washington Post editor, you know, what the story of the boy and, you know, the mark that's on his body, and followed it up and what his previous life, and just went through the whole thing. So here's the message that the conscious self is different than the body. The seat of consciousness is the soul. It's not the brain, like you hear in modern science explanation. That's what consciousness is. It's just neurological, neurochemical events. That's all it is. Not so. Not what modern science says. Anyway, these evidences that you've seen. And this is the last clip. This is Sariputta narrating the explanation that comes from the Sankhya philosophy of Lord Kapiladeva, the Sankhya philosophy of the Vedas, how the soul is distinct from the body, and how the soul, through the medium of the mind, can act to influence the events of the body that take place day to day. I hope it clicks. Well, we're not going to be able to do it. Nope. Anybody want to advise me what to do to get this to play?
Sugar.
Huh? Well, we won't see it in time. Okay. It's a nice presentation on Sankhya philosophy. Can you get the light back on? All of this is just besides giving you a little science class for the kids. too bad this last one didn't play. It's not just, you know, a sentiment or a belief that maybe I believe that there's a soul. There's evidence to indicate, in fact, there's a soul. Not going to work. And evidence doesn't mean proof, but evidence upon evidence upon evidence. At least we can say what consciousness isn't. And there's something, some entity, that endures beyond the body and exists apart from the body. That's the conscious self. And this video clip is saying that's called in Sanskrit language the Atma. And the Atma is who we really are. And the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita is also helping to make a clear distinction between the soul and the covering of the soul. There's gross coverings, which we can perceive, earth, water, fire, air, ether. There's subtle coverings also, mind, intelligence, and false ego. And together, chapter 7, Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says it's those two that are unconscious, and then there's the conscious self, para-prakriti. And, of course, Krishna is the controller of both. They're his prakriti, and because we're his energy, we're under his direction. Bhakti means accepting that fact. Krishna, we're under Krishna's direction. Since we're under Krishna's direction, the wise thing is to consider what is Krishna's interest, Krishna's desire, Krishna's will, and serve him accordingly. There's always a problem. The problem is we don't want to. We're rebellious. That's why we're here in the material world. In the 18th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that. Raga dvesha samutena dvandva mohena bharata. Moha means illusion. And the living entity becomes overcome by illusion because of these two things, raga and dvesha. We want to be in the position of being the enjoyer and controller. We want to be the Purusha. And there's a problem. Somebody else is already Purusha. The king is already sitting on the throne, and I want to sit on the throne. So I covet that position of the supreme enjoyer, and I have dvesha, or ill regard, towards him. He should come down and I should be there. Raga and dvesha. Based upon that, the living entity takes a material body, comes into this material atmosphere and struggles hard. Prakriti stani karshati. Very difficult struggle. And the message of Bhagavad Gita is to get released from that struggle. The first part of getting released from that struggle is to understand what the struggle is about, who we are. What our real identity is, this spirit soul, this particle of consciousness that's within this body, and the consciousness pervades the body. And let us learn the art of first understanding who we are and then acting on the platform of the soul. That's the second half of chapter 2, which you'll get to very soon. At least the Bhakti Bhikshu group members that are ending here. I hope it wasn't too rigorous, but at least it was like entertaining. Mm-hmm. Any discussion or questions or comments from anyone? Yes.
Generally, we understand that the control. The impact is like descending from the soul to the subtle body to the gross body. But this seems to indicate a reverse, that a change in the gross body is carried by the subtle body into the next body.
Not exactly, but something like that. The mind, when the gross body is finished, during the lifetime, our senses are sent. He showed that picture of the little boy and the man thinking, so res cogitans and res extensa, so the body and the mind. So the sense impressions are coming in. The eyes see, the ear hears, the nose smells. And sense impressions are coming in. It goes to the mind. It makes an impression. And the impression is stored subtly. Very, 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 very good storage system. Better than anything Microsoft can create. Really good data backup. And it's stored subtly. And after the time energy is working, and after some time, that stored impression comes out. It can come out in the form of a dream, it can come out in the form of a desire, and then we desire something. Or we dream something. But that's only possible because there's this sensory impression, and it's stored in the mind. Sense, the gross, is stored in the subtle mind. And then when the body is no longer inhabitable, the soul quits the body but is carried by the subtle body. So information is going from the senses to the mind. It's stored. And the mind carries, mind and intelligence and false ego, carry the soul to the next position of birth. So the mind is still there carrying that impression. It's stored until the time factor makes it manifest. And then the mind can influence matter also. Configurations of matter are influenced by states of mind. There are scientific experiments that have shown that, much to the chagrin of modern science. I remember Sataputta describing that there was a husband-wife couple also in the statistics department, just as George Gallup was part of the statistics department, and their field of study was parapsychology. And parapsychology is like a no-no. Meaning, you know, how the mind influences matter. That's parapsychology. And they were showing statistically it's so. Like, example after example after example, and pumping it out into the, you know, statistics magazines, and then finally they retired. And I saw the article when they retired, and, you know, like the professors in Princeton were indignant. How did these people become tenured professors teaching all this rubbish about parapsychology in Princeton University, in the statistics department of Princeton University? But they were demonstrating the mind influences matter. Statistically. Which, so just to repeat it, it goes against the laws of physics. Because the laws of physics say there's only one thing. Matter, the laws that govern matter. There's not something separate. Like a mind that influences the laws of matter. Come on. No such thing. But for a couple of decades they were showing it. So it goes, this is Descartes, that little picture. It goes back and forth. That was his proposition. He couldn't prove it, so it got debunked. That was 17th century. Here we are in the, you know, 21st century, and it's still like, you know, we can't stand this statistical information that proves that it's true. Mind influences matter. There's a predisposition against it. When they want it, because they want to prove something else. The evidence just gets trashed. If it's contrary. But that's not new. Anything else? Anyone? You have something.
Where is the how the anger gets generated?
Anger.
Yeah.
How does anger get generated?
Yeah.
Well, what does Krishna say in Bhagavad Gita? When there's contact with the soul, who wants to, the nature of the soul is Satchit Ananda. We're not the Supreme, but we're part and parcel of the Supreme. And the Supreme is Satchit Ananda, so we're Satchit Ananda. The drop of water is of the same nature as the ocean. So, our nature is we're blissful. We're in this material atmosphere because we want to enjoy as the enjoyer of nature. So that's the call, the mode of passion. Rajoguna. In contact with Rajoguna, kama arises. I want to enjoy. And then in a particular way. And when that enjoyment is not fulfilled, krodha, frustration, anger. Kamesha, krodesha, rajoguna samudbhava. By the living entity, which is spirit, contacting the mode of passion, the instrument by which we wish to enjoy, desire arises, frustration following desire. So Prabhupada said, described it this way, that anger has a older brother, and they have the same mother. The older brother is desire, and the mother is the mode of passion, or the soul contacting the mode of passion. Yehi samsparsha ja bhoga dukkha yonaya evate. From I'm wishing bhoga, I'm wishing to enjoy independently of the Supreme, and the result is dukkha. I'm frustrated, I didn't get the sukha, I got the dukkha. Not nice. I'm frustrated, I'm angry. But, you know, my way of seeing it is I may, you know, blame another person. My enjoyment was dependent upon you doing such and such, and you didn't do it. Why didn't you do it? It's your fault that I didn't enjoy. I'm angry with you. That's where anger comes from. It's in the mind. It's a state of mind that's one of the subsets of illusion. The initial illusion is we're not the enjoyer of matter. We're also Prakriti. We're Paraprakriti, but we're Prakriti. We're Prakriti of Krishna.
Is the anger carries on from birth to birth?
Well, the tendency to be an enjoyer stays with us, and the tendency from being the enjoyer, anger, we don't necessarily retain anger towards a particular event or a particular person or a particular configuration of matter, but the tendency carries with us. But the tendency is born from kama, and kama is born from contact with the mode of passion. So what's the solution?
Yeah, don't have contact with the
past. Yes! So instead, do what? Cultivate the quality of goodness. Yeah. And one of the quality... Here's what Bhishma Dev says about anger. To compensate for anger, or to neutralize anger, practice forgiveness. The mode of goodness. There's the saying, to err is human, to forgive is divine. You've heard that phrase before? Yeah? So to err is human. But to forgive, that's the mode of goodness. So you can choose, the soul has free will, the soul can choose to forgive or I want to enjoy and being frustrated after I didn't enjoy. I can choose between goodness and passion. Now, another lesson of Bhagavad Gita is the modes of nature are always competing. If there's a mode of passion, there's also some goodness and ignorance. If there's a mode of ignorance, there's also some goodness and passion. If there's a mode of goodness, there's also some passion and ignorance. And the others are competing for supremacy. So sometimes a person in the mode of goodness will become angry. And then mode of goodness again. So best is to take shelter of Shuddha Sattva. Not just Sattva, but pure goodness. And what's Shuddha Sattva? Vasudev is Shuddha Sattva. The Supreme Pure. If we associate with the Supreme Pure, we'll become supremely pure. And then forgiveness is second nature. We can still recognize right and wrong. And appropriate for the circumstance, we can take an action, but not out of anger, but out of what is to be done, what is not to be done in a given circumstance. Okay. Service to Krishna is the connection with Vasudev, this mood of serving Krishna. And, you know, the inhibiting rod in serving Krishna mood is this attitude, raga and dvesha problem towards Krishna specifically. We want to be the enjoyer. Instead of being our happiness being the enjoyed, the servant of the Supreme. Like the rebellious citizen doesn't want, you know, to be ruled by benevolent king. They want to be the king. That's their problem.
Among the win and the forgiveness, which is greater?
What are the two options? Forgiveness and what's the other option?
Winning.
Winning?
Winning. I have target.
To achieve your goal.
Yeah. Winning.
Well, if your goal, let me just modify your question. It's a nice question. That if you modify your question and say that Krishna's happiness should prevail, if that's the win, that's greater. And if my happiness is the win, then forgiveness is greater. Check me. So now how, next question, how do we get ourselves to the position we're thinking about winning means Krishna's happiness? Well, if you're holding on to something, supposing I'm thirsty and I'm holding the cartels and I want to get some water, so I have to put the cartels down before I can pick up the water. That's the question that, how do we release the material conceptions of life so that we can grasp the spiritual conception? And one recommended method is mantra. Mantra. Mantra means releasing the mind of the material conceptions. Mantra. Tra is release. Release the mind of material conception so that I can receive the spiritual conception. And then in that state, having chanted mantra, I hear the divine message of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna speaking. What's truth with a capital T or reality with a capital R? Then I can have the spiritual conception. But supposing I'm holding on to the material conception, I'm holding on to the material conception and I'm reading Bhagavad Gita, I'll misinterpret. I won't get the full message because I'm holding on to the material conception. So mantra combined with reading Bhagavad Gita and hearing its message is the prescribed method. Releasing the mind, a material conception, taking shelter of the spiritual conception from proper hearing. Actually, that conception is already there, just covered. It's knowledge that just needs to be awakened. It's already there. It's not importing something from outside and like learning how to something, learning how to operate a computer, or learning how to run a machine, or learning how to type, or learning how to ride a bicycle, or, you know, it's not a motor skill or some information processing thing. It's knowledge that's already there. And within the soul, at the soul level. Go ahead.
Without the consciousness or knowledge, what if a person tries for winning in his own way, like without even thinking about anything?
Well, that's ignorance. Without proper knowledge, what you just described is ignorance. It's passion and ignorance combined. Winning is passion, and ignorance is I don't know what's what, but I want to win. The recommendation is transfer that tendency to want to win to want Krishna to win, or let Krishna's will prevail. The Bible teaches that thy will be mine. That's love. Where the will of the beloved is my will. Whatever that is, that's what I want. That's love. Divine love. And the greatest form of happiness that exists is love. And divine love is the greatest form of love. The problem is we have a rebellious attitude towards Krishna. We want our will to win, not Krishna's. We're competing with Krishna. That's the name of the game. It's called Maya. You can't compete with Krishna. But we want to win. That's a lose. And the win is that his will become our will. Let us come to that stage. Now, what does Krishna want? He just wants us to be happy. But, you know, happy in an eternal sense of happy. Eternally happy. Unending, ever-increasing happiness. That's spiritual. Not this other kind. Temporary senses, sense object going, ah. Then it's oh. Yes.
I did not find an answer to this question for a long time. I heard.
Speak loud enough so they can hear you over there. I'll give you the microphone. I just project a little bit.
It's a long-standing question for me. I heard Lord Krishna said, out of millions and millions of people, only a few are really understanding him.
Hmm.
And out of those, hardly one or two are really reaching me.
That's not exactly what he says, but close.
Okay.
Bahunam janmanam ante gyanavan mam prapadyate vasadev sarvamiti samahatma sadurlabha.
That is true. We have billions and billions of people, at least a couple of billions of people on this earth and billions of creatures. When they are all going to really reach him?
Ah. Did you hear the question? The punchline. When are all the unlimited living entities going to reach him? It sounds like you have a presupposition that they must. Let's ask the question the other way around. Is it possible for a living entity, a stubborn, obstinate person, to not go to Krishna if they don't want to? Or is it that everyone must go to Krishna, even if they don't want to? Which is it? If they wish to, they can remain here perpetually. Let's emphasize it. Perpetually meaning like eternally here? Answer, yes. If they, Krishna doesn't interfere with their free will. He's inviting them. Like, you know, you can invite a child, be nice. And they're doing something else besides nice. You can encourage them, train them, induce them, help them. But they have their free will. And they sometimes like to demonstrate they have their free will. But so love is also a free will option. But without the other option, then it's not love. If it's forced, then it's not love. Look, I'm big and you're small, so you do what I say. That's not love. There's only one option. There's more than, there's multiple options. There's free will. The living entity exercises their free will. I don't want anything to do with you.
Free will has to be cut.
No, it's intrinsic to the soul. It can't be cut. No. Some people say like that. If that's the case, then why doesn't God just, like, if I ask Him to, will He take away my free will? So I just can't exercise it improperly anymore? Like get a lobotomy or something? But on the platform of the soul, there's no lobotomy. It's free will. Because in for two reasons. One, we're part of the Supreme. We have qualities like the Supreme. He's supremely independent. We have minute independence. Because we're part of the Supreme. We have qualities like Him. It's intrinsic. It's not something you can cut. And the other reason is, in the spiritual world, there's the existence of love. Without the option, there's no love. And there is love, so there is the option. It's just fundamental. It's something that's not taken from the soul, even if we want Krishna to take it. Rather, what we can do is, Krishna, please remove from my heart these impurities. Like Prahlad Maharaj prays like that to Lord Srinadeva. Please, with your sharp teeth and your pinching teeth and your sharp claws, tear from my heart all these impure desires and leave just this one desire, my love for you. Of course, that's he already has that condition, but he's praying like that. That's love. So let us exercise and act from the platform of love. Problem solved. Without a lobotomy. Without cutting our free will. Exercising the free will in a loving way. Anything else? Yes. All the activities over on this side. I'm going to get some little activity over on this side. Go ahead.
Like, my question is this one. Like, there's certain people, like innocent people.
There's innocent people.
Out there. And then they, like, kind of innocent, suppose they're poor people, innocent people. They are happy in their little lives, whatever they have. They don't enjoy life much, like, no sense, no. But still happy in those kind of situations, whatever they, like they get other adjusted to everything.
Okay.
So how do we see that? Like they are just satisfied in that situation.
They're less agitated by the illusion that says if I have things that makes me happy. You know, I've been to homes where they have like a playroom for their kids, and the playroom is filled with toys. And I see those children are not contented kids. And I see other homes where children, the mode of nature of different of is within the family, and they don't see, like, you know, tons of toys, and they're very contented. They're more peaceful because their happiness is more within, rather than having objects to engage their senses and distract them and, you know, bewilder them by those objects that don't ultimately satisfy, and so they're frustrated.
But they don't have Krishna, then...
Okay, but I'm just following your example of people that have and people that have not. The people that have not may be very contented and simple, and you know, contented with that simple life, in contrast with people that have. Now you're bringing God into the picture, and that temporary, the mode of goodness is not transcendence, because in the mode of goodness there's competition for the modes, and sometimes that contentedness is disrupted. They see somebody that has, and they wish, oh, I think I should have. And then a desire. And then, you know, a plan, and, you know, an endeavor, and to match the plan, and getting some of those things that they didn't have before, and that doesn't make them happy, so they think they just need more of those things, and then they can be happy, or a different set of those things, or...
Wouldn't it be difficult for them to accept Krishna because they...
No. I'll give as a practical example. In Russia, during the time of the heavy, oppressive Soviet rule, the people, there was heavy oppression, but the people were... They were not overindulging themselves in sense activity because they just didn't have it. The government saw to it they didn't have it. And Krishna consciousness was spreading very rapidly, undercover, but very rapidly. And then when Glasnost came, there was this big surge, and then it went down because people had so much sense gratification. Or let's look at India. Now that the economy is kabooming, look around and see what's happening in India. The style of life of people, particularly in urban, different than rural village life, but in urban life, religiosity and decency and morality and crime and corruption and all, it's another place. And now people have more money to do more things. Like one statistic that I read, this is maybe like 3 or 4 years ago, two or three years ago, was how much meat consumption there is in India. And the statistic was predicting it's going to hugely jump up. And it's not because it's down because people are religious, it's because they couldn't afford it. But when they can afford it, it's going to disappear. Vegetarianism is not totally disappear, but greatly diminish. Because the fabric is different. It's enjoy, because there's now prosperity. So when people don't, it's not like artificial depravity, but like let's say for us, when we're wanting to cultivate Krishna consciousness, it's ideal to live a simple life. Even if we may have the means for lavish life, if not extravagant life, but live simply. It's the quality of goodness. And one who lives simply, it's fertile ground for, so whether it's self-imposed or circumstance-imposed, it's good circumstance. Because mind isn't all over the place and sense is all over the place with bewildering material activity. Extra bewildering material activity. So we're advised, regardless of what your income capacity permits, live simply. Sama dhammak tapak shocham shantir arjavam evacha. We're encouraged like that. And one who makes more spiritual advancement, simplicity prevails all the more. It's just, what's the need? Like I was describing midday today, I was moved when I went to the house of the chief priest of Sri Rangam, one of the three chief priests in all of Sri Rangam. It's like this huge place. And I went inside and there's no furniture. If they wanted to sit down, you sit down on the floor. There wasn't a chair. There was a table in one room and a table in the other room, and four walls. And this is, you know, I'm sure they had the means to buy furniture. They just were living very simply. I don't know what was upstairs. This was in the downstairs area. That's all there was two tables, wooden tables. Simplicity, very clean. You know, you could feel how clean it was. It was really clean. So, simplicity, cleanliness. They foster God consciousness. Yeah. You have something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Say if a human, like, when they die in their next life, they become an animal.
That's possible.
Yeah, I know. Like, what if they, is it possible for them to remember their memories?
Well, how will we go ask the animal, have you remember your previous life? A little challenging, right? It's there in the Bhagavatam in reference to Bharat Maharaj, where he became a deer. So it's possible. But we have no way of finding out unless we read in the Bhagavatam. Good question.
One more question.
Yeah.
It's not my question, my daughter, she wants to answer.
Okay.
She asked me this morning, she was watching Lord Krishna's movie last week in the Bhaktivriksha class.
Okay.
And she asked me, how Lord Krishna being seen in multiple people? How can he do that?
How Krishna be seen by multiple people? Or in multiple people?
Yeah, in multiple people.
In the hearts of all living entities.
Yeah.
Like that?
No, that's what she meant.
Simultaneously.
They display Lord Krishna in all the people.
Oh.
So probably that's what she watched.
No difficulty. For us, it's a difficulty. It's like not even a difficulty. It's out of the question. But for Krishna, it's not a difficulty. Departure, eva hidisham taram avyupetya. Like a candle, dipa. You, from one candle, you can light so many candles, and then there's candles distributed everywhere. So similarly, Krishna expands himself in swangsa and vipinangsa and kala and different expansions where the potency is equal. Like one candle you light from another is the same heat and same light. Although the original is over here and the next one is over there. So Krishna expands himself without reducing himself. Om Purnat Adak Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate. That's so you can teach her that one.
Yeah, she knows that.
She knows that.
She knows that.
Teach her the meaning.
She's so little, I know.
All right.
But your candle example is perfect.
She yeah, in children's that. Words. Here's how you can do it as a child. Because this is what Prabhupada did for us when we were little children. Take a piece of paper and rip the piece of paper up into smaller pieces, hold it in your hand, and throw it into the middle of the floor. What happens? The original piece of paper is no longer, it's just in little pieces of paper throughout the floor. That's something material. But here's Krishna. Krishna can expand himself into so many Krishnas, so many papers, and Krishna is not reduced. Or, here's another way. Think of something that's... Challenge your daughter. Try to think of something that's so big. It's so big that you can take away some part of that thing that's so big and it's not reduced. Can you think of something that's that big? No, because no matter how big it is, something is less. That's how big Krishna is. So big that he can expand himself into equal Krishnas and small part and parcel living entities, and he's not reduced. Not even a little bit. That's Krishna. Achintya Shakti. He has inconceivable potencies. That's how he can do it. Defying the laws of nature, that's Krishna's program. He creates the laws and then he breaks the laws. Something else? You had something else? No. No. Okay. We're finished? Yes.
thank you very much for the class. I have one question, like, many people, going in process of going from a real conception of life to spiritual conception of life, they tend to try many other things, many other paths of spirituality, like this one, let me try this, that. So, I don't know what will be the destination, but is there a one thing that's helpful for everyone? By doing that just one thing, all other things are achieved.
Hare Krishna,
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare
Hare.
Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare
Hare. And it doesn't matter the language, it doesn't matter their culture, it doesn't matter. It's universal. Even they don't like it. Hare Krishna. Okay, thank you very much. Hare Prabhupada Ki Jai.